Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio from Monday, February 22nd, 2021. Here are some of your headlines. Attorney General nominee Merrick Garland telling the Senate Judiciary Committee that if he's confirmed, he'll keep politics out of the Justice Department. And his top priority will be prosecuting what he calls the heinous crimes by white supremacists and others who attacked the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. White House expressing confidence that the nomination for White House Budget Director Neera Tanden will be confirmed, even though it'll take at least one Republican. And two of them, seen as possible yeses, today said no, Susan Collins and Mitt Romney. Coronavirus deaths in the U.S. going over 500,000. Top U.S. infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci calling it a terribly historic milestone in the history of this country. President Joe Biden announcing a two-week exclusive window for the nation's smallest businesses to apply for emergency loans. House Budget Committee advancing a $1.9 trillion coronavirus economic relief bill on a party-line vote. And former President Donald Trump pledging to fight on after the Supreme Court declines to block the Manhattan District Attorney from obtaining his financial records. Former President calling the ongoing investigation politically motivated. Moments of silence today on Capitol Hill and at the White House, honoring the more than half a million coronavirus deaths in the U.S. in just one year. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi opening today's House session.
The chair asks all members in the chamber, as well as members and staff throughout the Capitol, to rise for a moment of silence in remembrance of more than 500,000 Americans who've passed away from the COVID-19 virus. Pursuant to Section 5A1B of the House Resolution 8, the House stands adjourned until 2 p.m. tomorrow.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Washington Post has an article looking at ways to visualize 500,000 coronavirus deaths. Say it's the size of a major U.S. city, more than the population of Kansas City, Missouri, almost as much as Atlanta. It's also the same as the number of people buried or will be buried in Arlington National Cemetery. We'll have more on this issue later in the program. Now to the confirmation hearing of Attorney General nominee Merrick Garland. He told senators on the Judiciary Committee today that the domestic terrorism threat epitomized by the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol is similar to what the Justice Department faced against the Ku Klux Klan and the 1995 bombing of a federal building in Oklahoma City.
Celebrating DOJ's 150th year reminds us of the origins of the department, which was founded during Reconstruction in the aftermath of the Civil War to secure the civil rights that were promised in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. The first Attorney General appointed by President Grant to head the new department led it in a concerted battle to protect black voting rights from the violence of white extremists. Successfully prosecuting hundreds of cases against white supremacist members of the Ku Klux Klan. Almost a century later, the Civil Rights Act of 1957 created the Department's Civil Rights Division, with a mission to uphold the civil and constitutional rights of all Americans, particularly some of the most vulnerable members of our society. That mission, on the website of the Department's Civil Rights Division, remains urgent because we do not yet have equal justice. Communities of color and other minorities still face discrimination in housing, in education, in employment, and in the criminal justice system. And they bear the brunt of the harm caused by pandemic, pollution, and climate change. 150 years after the department's founding, battling extremist attacks on our democratic institutions also remains central to the department's mission. From 1995 to 1997, I supervised the prosecution of the perpetrators of the bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building, who sought to spark a revolution that would topple the federal government. If confirmed, I will supervise the prosecution of white supremacists and others who stormed the Capitol on January 6th, a heinous attack that sought to disrupt a cornerstone of our democracy, the peaceful transfer of power to a newly elected government.
Part of Attorney General nominee Merrick Garland's opening statement today to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Garland is a federal judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit and perhaps best remembered as a Supreme Court nominee from President Barack Obama, a nominee who never got a hearing or a vote in the Senate. More from today's hearing, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham asking about international terrorism.
This is the 20th anniversary of 9/11. Are you concerned that Al-Qaeda and ISIS types are going to try to hit us again?
I am very concerned that foreign terrorist organizations will try to hit us again, yes. I don't know enough at this point about the capabilities of those two, but it really doesn't matter which foreign terrorist. The terrible thing is the attack. And as I said in my opening statement, with all the other things that the Justice Department has to do, it must always keep its eye on the ball with respect to foreign terrorist attack. I was sitting in my office, arriving at my office as the first plane hit the Trade Center, and I was sitting in my office and could see smoke rising over the Pentagon. I can assure you that this is top of mind for me.
Well, one of the reasons I am very inclined to support you is I believe what you just said is true. I think you have a very deep understanding of the threats America faces. And to my colleagues on the committee, Al-Qaeda has been diminished. ISIS footprint has been greatly diminished, but they're out there and they're trying to. They will this year sometime. I hope I'm wrong. Let us know they're still there. So it's great to hear the potential future Attorney General understanding that our nation is very much still under threat.
Senator Lindsey Graham. This from CNN.com. While Merrick Garland declined to weigh in on some of the controversies of the Trump administration, he strongly rebuked the Trump administration's child separation immigration policy, calling it shameful and committing to aiding a Senate investigation into the matter. Here's Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat and committee chair, asking the question.
Judge Garland, several years ago, I went to an immigration court hearing in downtown Chicago. It was in a high-rise loop building. I met the immigration court judge. She'd been on the job almost 20 years and seemed like a very conscientious and fair person. She asked me to stay for the docket call, particularly for the first clients on the docket. The first clients on the docket were a 4-year-old girl named Marta. When the judge asked that all of the people in the courtroom be seated, she had to be helped into the chair. It was too tall for her to get into. She was handed a stuffed animal to hold during the hearing. At the same table was a young boy with the unlikely name Hamilton, who was given a little matchbox car, which he played with on top of the table. He was 6 years old. They were the victims of the zero tolerance policy. We remember it well. Thousands of children were forcibly removed from their parents, separated, and many times lost in the bureaucracy. Some have incorrectly stated that that administration policy by the Trump administration was just a continuation of Obama-era policy. That isn't true. The Obama administration did not have policies that resulted in the mass separation of parents and children. And on rare occasions separations occurred, this was due to suspicion of trafficking or fraud, not because of an intentional, cruel policy to separate children. The Justice Department's Inspector General conducted an investigation of the zero tolerance policy and noted that the Justice Department was, quote, the driving force, close quote, in that policy. There is still a lot that we do not know about that policy and the accountability for the officials who were responsible for it. So let me ask you this. This committee is going to hold oversight hearings to get to the bottom of it. Will you commit to cooperate with those investigations?
Senator, I think the oversight responsibility of this committee is one of its very most important things. It's a duty imposed by the Constitution, and I greatly respect it. I think that the policy was shameful. I can't imagine anything worse than tearing parents from their children. and we will provide all of the cooperation that we possibly can.
I thank you for that.
The Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Dick Durbin with Attorney General nominee Merrick Garland. Another Democrat, Cory Booker, focusing on criminal justice reform, and that led to this exchange touching on Garland's family history.
It gets back to me to your conviction in this issue and your determination to go down at a time when our nation needs this, to go down as one of the great leaders when it comes to dealing with the daily unconscionable injustices faced by some Americans and not others at the hands of law enforcement. And I think that one thing you said to me privately particularly motivated me to believe you when you talk about your aspirations. And I'm wondering if you could just conclude by answering the question about your motivation and maybe some of your own family history in confronting hate and discrimination in American history.
Yes, Senator. So, I come from a family where my grandparents fled anti-Semitism and persecution. The country took us in. Protected us. And I feel an obligation to the country to pay back. And this is the highest, best use of my own set of skills to pay back. And so I want very much to be the kind of attorney general that you're saying I could become. And I'll do my best to try and be that kind of attorney general.
I believe your heart, and I'm grateful that you are living that MICA mandate.
Senator Cory Booker with the nominee. This is Washington Today, and a reminder that you can find the entire hearing, confirmation hearing with Merrick Garland to be Attorney General at our video library at cspan.org. Reporting at Fox News, Judge Merrick Garland on Monday said he has not discussed the federal investigation into Hunter Biden's tax affairs with President Biden. Hunter Biden confirmed that he was under federal investigation for his tax affairs in December, investigation being led out of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Delaware. A source telling Fox News the investigation was predicated in part on suspicious activity reports regarding suspicious foreign transactions, and the investigation began in 2018. That was all reporting from Fox News. Hunter Biden is the son of President Joe Biden. Here's the question to Merrick Garland from Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican.
My last question will have to deal with the investigation that's underway by some of us in Congress about Hunter Biden. Have you discussed the case with the president or anyone else? And I don't expect you to discuss your private conversation with the president, but members of this committee always ask judges or other people, did you discuss with the president, for instance, your position on abortion? So have you discussed this Hunter Biden case with the president or anyone else?
I have not. The president made abundantly clear in every public statement before and after my nomination that decisions about investigations and prosecutions will be left to the Justice Department. That was the reason that I was willing to take on this job. And so the answer to your question is no.
With more on Attorney General nominee Merrick Garland's confirmation hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, joining us now is Alana Shore, congressional editor with Politico. Thanks for being with us. Before we get to the issues covered today, did anything happen today that might put this nomination in jeopardy of not being confirmed?
I would say definitely no. And, the reason for that is really that of all the possible attorney general picks that President Biden could have made, Merrick Garland is a pretty straight down the middle choice who was popular with Republicans even before the nomination. I mean, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell suggested him to lead the FBI back in 2017.
Well, some of the issues that came up today, he raised it right off the bat, domestic terrorism and the attack on the Capitol. What did he say?
Well, he signaled to lawmakers that he was going to make that a very big priority for his DOJ going forward. And indeed, DOJ is already revealing that it has scores upon scores of active investigations into that insurrection. He did also make an interesting note, which is, you know, former Judge Garland said, of course, I support, obviously, the goals of this proposed 1-6 commission, an independent body that Democrats want to investigate the insurrection inspired by the 9/11 commission. But he also said it's important that that commission's work doesn't step on those ongoing investigations against dozens and dozens of rioters.
Many Democrats bringing up an issue that came up quite a bit last year in the Black Lives Matter movement: death penalty, prison reform, criminal justice reform. What were they asking for?
Oh, well, you know, they were looking to try to pin down Garland on all of those issues, how quickly he'll prioritize them. You know, many senators are interested in taking a second bite at the apple on criminal justice reform after the so-called First Step Act, which, you know, was a big bipartisan success, one of the only ones of the Trump years. So, you know, Garland obviously told them positive things, but didn't really offer any super clear time commitments, which would be pretty rare for a nominee.
And the Republicans, many of them focusing on the investigations that have been going on at the Justice Department, on the origins of the Russia investigation, also Hunter Biden.
Yes, that was perhaps one of the more dramatic moments of an otherwise smoothish hearing when Garland got pressed to address the Durham investigation. One prominent Republican, Tom Cotton, noted that Bill Barr, who was Trump's second nominee, gave a wider berth to the Robert Mueller investigation when asked if he would allow a probe that might hurt a president to keep going. And I think it was Cotton's sense that Garland was less than fully supportive of letting Durham do exactly what he needs to do. But to be sure, Garland wasn't unsupportive. He merely said, you know, I don't know as much as I should know yet on this, and I'll have to get back to you.
This is day one of 2 days of hearings for Attorney General nominee Merrick Garland. The second day is going to be outside witnesses. Do we know who they are?
Yes. Perhaps the biggest name on the list will be familiar to Clinton administration watchers back in the 90s. That is Ken Starr, who served as the special counsel investigating the Lewinsky intern issue during the Clinton years. Now, he's going to be a witness for the minority, so one would suspect that he would delve potentially into some of these special counsel issues about Durham that we just finished discussing. Other witnesses: Wade Henderson, who's a major civil rights advocate and activist, a law professor from Texas, named Professor Josh Blackman, and the former director of the Executive Office of U.S. Attorneys, a group that is firmly behind Garland, will be testifying on his behalf.
And finally, Merrick Garland, perhaps most well-known to our listeners as a Supreme Court nominee for a brief time under President Obama, never got a Senate hearing or a vote. Did anybody bring that up today?
Surprisingly, it didn't become much of an issue. And I think the reason is, you know, there's not really a lot of political gain for either side here in rehashing old history. You know, I think the Biden administration wants this nominee to not be mired in past dramas and to get as many Republican votes as possible. And Republicans seem prepared to give them quite a lot of votes based on what we saw today.
Alana Shore, congressional editor with Politico. Read her work at politico.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the Senate Judiciary Committee Chair, Dick Durbin, saying the committee will be voting on the Merrick Garland nomination on March 1st, setting up a Senate floor confirmation vote later next week. Just over a month into the Joe Biden presidency, the Senate has confirmed 6 of his 15 cabinet nominations: State, Defense, Treasury, Transportation, Veterans Affairs, and Homeland Security. Comparing that to previous presidents at the one-month point, President Donald Trump had 8 confirmed nominees on the cabinet level, Barack Obama 14, and George W. Bush 11. But the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has teed up 4 nominations this week, including Linda Thomas-Greenfield for U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, Jennifer Granholm to lead the Energy Department, and Miguel Cardona to lead the Education Department. Washington Today continues in a minute. And welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. The Supreme Court turning away an appeal by former President Donald Trump to shield his tax returns and other financial records from a New York grand jury subpoena. Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr. tweeting, "The work continues." Former President Trump issuing a lengthy written statement. It begins, "This investigation is a continuation of the greatest political witch hunt in the history of our country." And it goes on, "The new phenomenon of headhunting prosecutors and AGs who try to take down their political opponents using the law as a weapon is a threat to the very foundation of our liberty. That's what is done in third world countries." Also, state lawmakers in Virginia passing legislation to end capital punishment. Governor Ralph Northam expected to sign it. Virginia will then become the 23rd state to have stopped executions. In the history of the U.S., Virginia has executed more people than any other. That dates back to colonial times. And the Food and Drug Administration saying modified COVID-19 vaccines against new emerging variants may be authorized without the need for lengthy clinical trials. ABC News reporting, as the United States nears 500,000 COVID-19 deaths, Dr. Anthony Fauci telling Good Morning America on Monday, the U.S. has done worse than most any other country in the battle against the coronavirus, despite being a highly developed, rich country. One in every 656 Americans has now succumbed to the virus, with 525,600 minutes in 1 year, 500,000 deaths, equivalent to approximately one American dying from COVID-19 per minute for almost an entire year. That was from ABC News. Here is Dr. Fauci with GMA host George Stephanopoulos.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, 500,000 Americans, families grieving all across the country. Did this have to be?
Well, certainly some of it, but not this bad, George. I mean, I believe that if you look back historically, we've done worse than most any other country. And we're a highly developed, rich country. So there were things back then that if you go back and think about what you might have done, the kind of disparate responses of different states rather than having a unified approach. But, you know, it's so tough to just go back and try and, you know, do a metaphorical autopsy on how things went. It was just bad. It is bad now. I think these numbers are so stunning, George. You know, remember back in the late winter and early spring of 2020, when we were saying we could get as high as 240,000, and people were thinking we were being hyperbolic about it, and now here we are with a 500,000 deaths, just a stunning figure. The only thing that I would just encourage all of us is that rather than looking back and saying what the heck happened here, just saying now let's just go forward and be completely committed as a unified country to just go at this together. This is a common enemy. We've all got to pitch in. We're in some good shape now with the vaccines, but it's going to be a race against the infections that keep coming and our ability to do two things and do it well. One, continue to do the public health measures that we speak about all the time, the uniform wearing of masks, the physical distancing, the avoiding congregate settings. At the same time, as we do everything we can to get vaccines into the arms of people as quickly and as efficiently as possible, that is the weapons that we have against this horrible disease.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, the Biden administration chief science advisor, on ABC News Monday morning. The Health and Human Services Department says that 13% of the U.S. has received one or more coronavirus vaccine doses. That's nearly 43 million people. And 5% of the U.S. has received two doses. From the New York Post, 11 elected members of the New York State Democratic Party submitting a resolution to censure Governor Andrew Cuomo over his coronavirus nursing home scandal, including covering up the true number of deaths among nursing home residents from the killer virus, protecting medical facilities from legal liability for negligence, and threatening lawmakers for criticizing his policies. Governor Cuomo has taken responsibility for the undercounting of deaths, but has stopped short of an apology. It's not good enough for New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, a fellow Democrat.
No, I have not spoken to him. No, I do not accept his explanation. There needs to be a full investigation. Thousands of lives were lost. Families deserve answers. We need to get the whole truth here. We need to make sure that nothing like this ever happens again.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio today. Other Democrats calling for an investigation of Governor Cuomo include Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York and New York City mayoral candidate Andrew Yang, a former presidential candidate. President Joe Biden says that the smallest of small businesses will go to the front of the line for 2 weeks now to apply for emergency coronavirus pandemic loans under the federal program called the Paycheck Protection Act. President Biden speaking from the Eisenhower Executive Office Building right next to the White House.
On Wednesday, the Small Business Administration is going to establish a 14-day exclusive PPP loan application period for businesses and nonprofits with fewer than 20 employees. People can go out and find how to get a hold of these loans. People can find out more at the SBA.gov. Small Business Administration will also remove barriers that have stopped many businesses from being able to apply for these loans. For example, we're making it so that a student loan default or a non-fraud-related criminal record does not prohibit someone from applying for the program. We're also making it easier for those one-person businesses, like the home repair contractors, beauticians, small independent retailers, to secure forgivable PPP loans. At the same time, we're increasing access by increasing oversight. I invite any inspector general in this program with jurisdiction over this program to closely look at these loans and publicly report on any issues they uncover inconsistent with what I'm saying today. We will ensure every dollar is spent well. These changes will bring much-needed, long-overdue to help to small businesses who really need help staying open, maintaining jobs, and making ends meet. And this is a starting point, not the ending point. We need Congress to pass my American Rescue Plan. It deals with the immediate crisis facing our small businesses. Now, critics say the plan is too big. But let me ask them a rhetorical question. What would you have me cut? What would you leave out? The American Rescue Plan targets $50 billion to support the hardest hit small businesses after this program expires at the end of March.
President Joe Biden at the Eisenhower Executive Office Building. Politico writes that less than half of the PPP's more than $284 billion in current funding has been used since it relaunched January 11th, with little concern that it would be exhausted. But the program has been dogged by concern since its creation last year that it was failing to reach the hardest-hit employers, particularly minority-owned businesses that lack relationships with banks responsible for processing PPP applications. President Biden, as you heard, mentioning that Congress should pass his proposed coronavirus economic relief plan, $1.9 trillion. Well, today, the House Budget Committee passed a version that the House Democrats put together. It was a party-line vote, 19-16. The Democrats, yes. The Republicans, no. The chairman is John Yarmuth. He opened the session.
Members of the committee, the bill before us today has the power to save lives and save our nation's economic future. I kicked off the reconciliation process with the introduction of the 2021 budget resolution 21 days ago on February 1st. From the start, we have been upfront that the sole purpose of the budget resolution was to provide the option of using reconciliation to deliver critical relief and enact the American Rescue Plan. That process has not precluded us from reaching a bipartisan agreement, but it has ensured that Congress can move forward and meet the needs of the American people with or without Republican cooperation. 2 weeks ago, 9 different House committees marked up their portions of this rescue plan. In total, these committees deliberated for more than 94 hours and debated more than 400 amendments. We will add at least another 5 hours of deliberation today, as well as debate on 13 motions to instruct. We have been thorough, but this has been by no means a normal reconciliation process. Yes, we have followed all the House rules and proper procedures, but we have done so knowing the devastation that is happening in and to our communities every day. This February, an American has died of COVID every 32 seconds. So while debate is important, we also need to get on with it. This virus is evolving. Multiple variant strains of the novel coronavirus are already infecting Americans across the United States. Researchers and health professionals are bracing for a new wave of cases from the B.1.17 variant, which is more contagious and highly infectious for both adults and children. We are in a race against time. Aggressive, bold action is needed before our nation is more deeply and permanently scarred by the human and economic costs of inaction. We have the plan to beat the virus, to safely reopen schools, to quickly and equitably distribute vaccines, to deliver immediate relief to working families and small businesses, to support communities struggling with the economic fallout.
The Budget Committee Chair in the House, John Yarmuth, a Democrat. The bill the committee passed today includes $1,400 checks for Americans that earn $75,000 or less, or $2,800 for couples earning $150,000 or less, plus another $1,400 per dependent. Renewal of the Paycheck Protection Program for small business loans, enhanced food aid for families, funding for schools to reopen, funding for transit and airports, an extension of the $400 a week boost in federal unemployment benefits through the end of August, and an increase in the federal minimum wage to $15 per hour by 2025. Speaking in opposition today, the Budget Committee ranking Republican Jason Smith.
But turning to the legislation before us today, simply put, this is the wrong plan at the wrong time and for all the wrong reasons. It's the wrong plan because this bill will directly harm America's working class. It sends $510 billion to state and local governments that only further rewards state lockdowns. These lockdowns do not just hit a business's bottom line or a family's pocketbook. When you board up local small businesses, you force kids out of school and parents out of work, closes houses of worship, that can do real harm to the physical and mental health of individuals and families. It is the wrong plan because this bill spends $471 billion on policies that will reduce employment and destroy jobs. There has been a lot of attention paid to the $15 Washington mandate in this bill, and whether Democrats will shred the reconciliation process in order to force it through. That is certainly concerning, but also concerning is how this policy would destroy millions of jobs, at least 1.4 million, according to the Congressional Budget Office, and disproportionately harm low-wage workers, disabled workers, and less educated workers. It is the wrong plan, because also packed into the $471 billion is an expansion of unemployment insurance to the point where more than half of Americans would earn more money from unemployment benefits than working. More Obamacare subsidies that CBO has said will lead to fewer hours worked. This bill would even establish a form of universal basic income, which will again lead to Americans working less.
Congressman Jason Smith, top Republican on the Budget Committee. Again, the bill was voted out of committee today on a party line vote. As for the next steps, the Hill newspaper writes the bill must still be marked up by the Rules Committee before consideration on the House floor, likely on Friday or Saturday. The legislation will then have to be taken up by the Senate, where it is expected to face considerable procedural and political challenges. Democrats may struggle to pass certain portions of the bill in the Senate, where they hold a 50-50 majority with Vice President Kamala Harris's tie-breaking vote, and policies such as the $15 minimum wage may not pass muster under strict budget rules and also have detractors among the Democratic caucus. You can read more at thehill.com. On Wall Street today, the Dow up 27, S&P down 30. NASDAQ falling 341. Reuters explains the S&P 500 and NASDAQ fell on Monday as climbing treasury yields and prospects of rising inflation triggered valuation concerns, hitting shares of high-flying growth companies. Also, Canada considering joining Great Britain and temporarily banning certain Boeing 777s from Canadian airspace, depending on what investigators uncover about an engine fire forcing a 777 to land shortly after takeoff from Denver over the weekend. Several airlines already grounding their fleets of 777s with those engines. In Great Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson laying out a plan to gradually lift coronavirus restrictions on his country's businesses, schools, and venues. Each phase of the four-step reopening plan will be dependent on certain benchmarks being met, including vaccines being shown to reduce hospitalizations and deaths, and also no discovery of any new COVID variants. The Prime Minister Boris Johnson addressing Parliament in London.
2 weeks from today, pupils and students in all schools and further education settings can safely return to face-to-face teaching, supported by twice-weekly testing of secondary school and college pupils. Families and childcare bubbles will also be encouraged to get tested regularly. Breakfast and after-school clubs can also reopen, and other children's activities, including sport, can restart where necessary to help parents to work. Students on university courses requiring practical teaching, specialist facilities, or on-site assessments will also return. But all others will need to continue learning online, and we will review the options for when they can return by the end of the Easter holidays. From the 8th of March, people will also be able to meet one person from outside their household for outdoor recreation, such as a coffee on a bench or a picnic in a park, in addition to exercise. But we're advising the clinically extremely vulnerable to shield at least until the end of March. Every care home resident will be able to nominate a named visitor able to see them regularly, provided they are tested and wear PPE. And finally, we will amend regulations to enable a broader range of COVID-secure campaign activities for local elections on the 6th of May. As part of step one, we will go further and make limited changes on 29th of March when schools go on Easter holidays. It will become possible to meet in limited numbers outdoors where the risk is lower. So the rule of six will return outdoors, including in private gardens, and outdoor meetings of two households will also be permitted on the same basis so that families in different circumstances can meet. Outdoor sports facilities such as tennis and basketball courts and open-air swimming pools will be able to reopen, and formally organised outdoor sports will resume subject to guidance. From this point, 29th of March, people will no longer be legally required to stay at home, but many lockdown restrictions will remain. People should continue to work from home where they can and minimise all travel wherever possible.
The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson before the House of Commons. The Independent newspaper adds that the British government is considering the introduction of COVID status certificates as part of plans for the phased reopening of society. But the government would be mindful of concerns surrounding privacy, exclusion, and discrimination, with some groups unable to receive a coronavirus jab for medical reasons. Back in the U.S., White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki expressing support for Neera Tanden, President Biden's nominee to lead the Office of Management and Budget, but the votes may in the end not be there. One Democrat has already said he'll vote no, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, and that means at least one Republican will need to vote yes for Tanden to be confirmed. Two Republicans viewed as possible have now said no, Susan Collins and Mitt Romney, both citing Tanden's past tweets criticizing Republicans and some Democrats. Susan Collins writing, Neera Tanden has neither the experience nor the temperament to lead this critical agency. Her past actions have demonstrated exactly the kind of animosity that President Biden has pledged to transcend. Here's a reporter's question today to the White House Press Secretary, Jen Psaki.
All right, Josh, we'll go to you.
Thanks, Jen. Two questions. You touched on the issue of nominations and confirmations. Mm-hmm. Given the statements of Senator Manchin, Senator Collins, Senator Romney, what do you see as Neera Tanden's path to become director of OMB? And also, what does it mean for the Biden agenda if this process keeps on being delayed and drawn out?
The process of confirmations?
Yeah.
Well, let me start with that. I would say that we experienced some intransigence during the transition, some delays in processes that had previously worked at a more rapid pace. Our view is that we've hopefully moved past that. We've seen a number of our nominees move forward over the past couple of weeks pretty quickly with large bipartisan votes, and we certainly welcome that. But we are eager to have our team in place. This week has a number of important hearings. There are a number of important votes this week. We would love to end the week with a Secretary of Education in place as an example, and certainly others as we look to have the full team and hopefully a full cabinet meeting at some point in the near future. As it relates to Neera Tanden, let me just say that the president nominated her because he believes she'd be a stellar OMB director. She's tested. She's a leading policy expert. She's led a think tank in Washington that has done a great deal of work on policy issues, but has done a great deal of bipartisan work as well. She's won widespread support and endorsements, ranging from labor unions to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And she's rolled up her sleeves and done the work. She's met with more than 35 senators, Democrats and Republicans herself. This is a process. Confirmations, getting individuals confirmed is. She has two committee votes this week, and we're working toward that, and we'll continue to work in supporting her nomination.
Do you still see a path to 50 votes or more?
We do.
The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki during her regular daily briefing in the White House briefing room. And those two committees that will take up the Neera Tanden nomination for White House Budget Director, Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs, and Senate Budget. Well, thanks for joining us on Washington Today. It's available as a podcast. You can subscribe so you don't miss any episodes. And also the free C-SPAN Radio app gives you not only the audio stream of C-SPAN Radio wherever you are, but also the audio of the three C-SPAN TV networks. I hope you have a good night.